You're listening to a production of the Center for Emerging Media. We hope you'll consider making a donation to us to help us continue to bring you these podcasts. Just go to our website and click on Donate. I'm Mark Steiner, and I'm sitting here with Julia Butterfly Hill, as she is known. Julia Hill was made famous in America because for 738 days between December 10th, 1997 and December 18th, 1999, she lived in a tree in California, the tree that was known as Luna. She did that to stop the loggers from the Pacific Lumber Company from cutting it down, and became a very known a well-known American activist and environmentalist because of that. We're lucky that she came through Baltimore because one of our great institutions here, the American Visionary Arts Museum, AVAM, down in South Baltimore, has an incredible exhibit that Julia Hill's work is part of, and she never before released her writings or her drawings to anybody until Rebecca Hofberger curated this exhibit at the museum, and she came through Baltimore to be part of one of their visionary conversations and joined us here so you all could have this for posterity and more. So that's why we're sitting here with Julia in Baltimore Live today, which is great. And many people thought she was just some crazed barefoot hippie living in a tree, and they should just cut the tree down with her in it.
Yeah, that's granola munching, tree hugging, radical extremist, wacko hippie, foo foo new ager to you. Thank you very much.
Excuse me. Welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
So, let me just ask you this. I mean, I think that's a good place to start because many people who will know of you, and as soon as I introduced you that way, they know, they remember, if they don't know you, if your name doesn't stay with them or whatever, they remember that lady in that tree.
Right. The girl who lived in the tree.
So, talk a bit about that for everybody, to set the framework for that moment, what that forest was, and what led you to the top of that tree.
It's such a challenge to try and encapsulate it in a short period of time because I can look at so many things in my life that led me to that tree.
That's right. We're not gonna give you little teeny pieces to talk. You can explain the whole thing.
Well, that would take days. You know, okay. It's really, there's so many pieces. But I will reflect back to a car wreck I had in 1996. I was hit by a drunk driver, and the steering wheel of the car went into my skull, and it took 10 months of physical and cognitive therapy to recover parts of my short-term memory and my motor skills. And during that time, I really had a wake-up call. I tell people, you know, the steering wheel in my skull literally and figuratively steered me in a new direction in my life. And what it really made me question is, what is real value? Because I had kind of done the American success story. I was raised extremely poor, went to college, majored in business with a minor emphasis in arts, co-opened a restaurant when I was 18 years old, did many different things, became a consultant. You know, I made something of myself. I had that kind of the all-American dream, in quotes, of starting somewhere low and working my way up. And yet, it, as with many people, it was never quite satisfying. It didn't seem like I ever was finding that thing for me. So the car wreck really made me go, what is real value? Why am I here? What is my purpose on this planet? That sent me on a search. And I was actually just traveling with some acquaintances on a road trip. And we reached California, and we split away on this incredible place called the Lost Coast. It's just extraordinary, miles and miles of untouched coastline. And we all kind of took a break, as you know, going on road trips,
right.
You need breaks.
Right, exactly.
So we took breaks, went our separate ways. And when I came back from that hike, I knew that I wasn't supposed to go any further. And I actually had no clue why, but I just was this deep knowing that I was meant to end my part of the road trip there. So I gave my acquaintances some money for the rest of the trip and said, have an amazing time. I'll see you when I see you. And I got off the road trip in California.
Well, what was there when you did that?
What was where?
Literally around you.
Oh, well, we were actually at this place at the Lost Coast. It's a drop-off point. So I could hitch in and out of town to get supplies and things like that I needed. But it's about 32 miles approximately in one direction and over 25 miles in the other direction of undeveloped coastline.
Mm-hmm.
So gorgeous pathways, some of them along beaches, some of them along cliffs. There's bears and mountain lions and seals and deer and birds of all kinds. And it's just, it's a very magical place, and most people who go there say that. There's just something special about this place. So that's, we split ways at the drop-off point. And I was in town actually doing some laundry, getting some supplies, and was told about this place called EPIC, the Environmental Protection Information Center. And I went in, and that's where I saw activism for the first time. And in for the forest. And I had already entered, I had to backtrack, sorry, I had entered the redwoods and already by this point and had just been blown away. There's just something about walking into the presence of trees that are 2,000 to 3,000 years old and 200 to 300 feet tall, that all of that human ego that makes us think we're so big and so important.
Dwarfs you literally and figuratively, right?
Yeah.
Right.
It's like, whoo. And you can feel, you know, these forests, it takes 500 years to create 1 inch of topsoil in these forests. 1 inch of soil takes 500 years. So we're talking about if a tree is 2,000 to 3,000 years old, it's sitting in a forest that's a millennium. You know, I mean, that's millions of years. It's just, you just feel that sacred presence. And for people who aren't even spiritual, I think most people, not all, but most people, when they enter the redwoods, something shifts in them very deeply when you walk in and when you leave. You come out of the forest different than you walked in. For me, being a deeply spiritual person, I had a very sacred experience. And it touched me so profoundly. And then I walked into my first clear cut. And I didn't know it at the time.
Clear cut of trees in a forest, you mean, for logging purposes.
That's right. And the clear cuts, the process they use in the logging there is so destructive. So they go in, they cut all or most of the trees. Then, I didn't know this at the time, I just witnessed the destruction, but this is the process they go through. After they cut down all the trees, there's all these branches and twigs left, which are a fire hazard. So by fire law, they're told to quote-unquote clean it up. And the way of cleaning it up is to put it all in piles and light the clear cuts on fire with diesel fuel and in some cases napalm. So you, when they're done in these places, then they will come back and they say, well, we plant 2 trees for every 1 we cut down. Well, they fail to mention the trees they're cutting down are hundreds to thousands of years old, and they come in and they plant little tiny seedlings in an area, in a zone that literally looks like a bomb has gone off, that's so toxic most of those little trees can't even grow because there's no nutrients left for them to grow in. So that's what I walked into. This just like literally looking like a bomb had blown out a huge portion of the forest. And I dropped to my knees and I started sobbing because I just couldn't believe that we would do this. We don't have the ability to replace 2,000 to 3,000 year old trees. We just, what are we thinking? And I just sobbed. I just couldn't believe. I was so naive that I didn't think that we would do this. And what's incredible is I've learned over time that I'm not the only one. There's so many, I mean, literally thousands, tens of thousands of people who've written letters and sent emails and things from all over the world saying, I didn't know they were still cutting redwoods down. And then I found
that. Are they still?
They are. Yeah, there's still it's getting better. We actually had a really great success story last week. The corporation that I protested, Maxam Corporation, it's a out-of-state corporate raider. And they took over Pacific Lumber, which was a family-owned operation for over 100 years. And because it was a family-owned operation, the people lived there. So there was a lot more give and take in the dialogue around how to log in that area. Because if your neighbors live downstream from where you're logging and you cause a mudslide, there's a much quicker repercussion. You actually care more. It's your neighbors, your family, your friends.
Right.
So they actually, although they weren't the kind of logging company that I think were capable of being, they were certainly a lot better. But then an out-of-state corporation comes in, takes over the company, and they don't care. They're just there to liquidate the profits. But less, they did what they do as a corporation. They liquidated the assets, put the company into bankruptcy. Their goal was to be able to renegotiate all their fees and their debt so that they could keep liquidating the forests and not owe the people money. And the judge actually ruled against their restructuring plan last week and voted in favor of a company called Mendocino Redwood Company to take over Maxam Corporation. And again, Mendocino Redwood Company, not my most favorite logging company, but they implement what's called SmartWood Certified FSC, Forest Stewardship Council certification on all their logging lands. And currently in the United States, it's the highest form of certification we have. It's similar to like an organic standard for food. It's that standard for timber. So we actually have a huge success as of last week. Maxam Corporation is no longer in over 15 years of struggle. It's now done.
So when you, to the point where you decided to go in the tree, take us to that place before we go off into some more recent activities.
Right. What happened for me when I was deeply touched by the beauty and then just as equally devastated by the destruction, and I thought, I have to do something. And then being a human being that I am, I thought, well, what can I do? Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't come from an activist background per se. I didn't know where to begin. I, as is often the case, I think, with many of us, in particular in production-driven societies, we have this ongoing unspoken conversation called not enough. I'm not smart enough, rich enough, I don't know enough, I don't have enough time, I don't have enough resources. We have this ongoing unspoken but prevalent conversation called not enough. And I fell into that conversation with myself. You know, what can I do? I'm just one person. I don't know how to do this. And yet, when I was praying, the answer that came to me was, Julia, if you have the opportunity to at least try to make a difference, and you choose to silence yourself and walk away, it's the same thing as participating in that injustice. Anywhere in the world, if you have the ability to speak out, to make a difference, to even attempt, if you don't make that attempt, it's the same thing as supporting the very same injustice that's breaking your heart. And it was just a clear call to action. And I call it the choiceless choice, that great love calls forth great action, even when we don't see it coming sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it's usually good when we don't see it coming.
That's right.
If I had seen what was coming, I never would have done it. And so the choiceless choice was, Julia, you could choose to walk away, but you can't choose to walk away. You have to do something. So I just started trying to figure out what it was I could do. And I, through a long series of events, ended up at this place called Base Camp, which was the camp area where all these different forest actions were kind of centered. And then people would go out into the forest and then come back for resupplies, changing up of people, trainings, all that kind of thing. But when I ended up at Base Camp, it was the end of the season. They'd never had a tree sit go through the wintertime before, so there wasn't really anyone left there. This one day, this guy was walking around saying, I need someone to sit in Luna. I need someone to sit in Luna. And this other activist had already pointed Luna out on the hillside above base camp. And he had said, you see that big tree up there? And it's very noticeable because it's the largest tree on the top of the hillside. And I said, yes. And I said, what's that? And he said, that's a tree sit. And I said, what's a tree sit? And he said, that's where people sit in trees in order to protect them. And he's from Detroit. So he's like, that's where people sit in trees in order to protect them, man. And I was like, oh, wow, cool, okay. So when this guy was walking around saying, we need someone to sit in Luna, I volunteered. Because although I didn't really know how to be an activist, I wasn't exactly in my head even sure what does activism mean. I grew up with two brothers and no sisters, so I've climbed a lot of trees.
A lot of trees, right.
And I was like, tree city, I can do that. I can do that. Pick me. And it was so funny because they didn't know me. And when you're doing direct action, there's a lot of risks, including infiltration from the government. And a lot of my friends are in jail right now as terrorists. They dare to say things like eco-terrorists. It's like, well, I think corporations that are dropping diesel fuel and napalm on the ancient forest, that's an eco-terrorist, not someone who's sitting in trees or locking down the gates. So there was a lot of suspect around my showing up, which is, I understand it now. At the time, I didn't. It hurt my feelings because I'm all like naive and sensitive and I just want to help. And they're all like, we don't know you, go away. And but then as I learned more about the history and what's happening in activism, the kind of things that they do to take people down in this country, I realized later on why. But they didn't want to pick me to sit in Luna, but I kept following this guy around going, no, I really want to do it. I really want to do it. And no one else would volunteer. And so he had to pick me.
And no choice.
And that's how I ended up in climbing up into Luna. And I'm most famous for what was actually my third tree sit. I went up once for 6 days, I came down for 1 day, I went back up for 5 days, and then I came down for 3 weeks. And what was interesting was, in those 3 weeks, I didn't think tree sitting was for me, because coming from a business background, I was seeing all this energy going into these tree sits and not a lot coming out. And I thought, it's important. If someone can only sit for a few days, which at that time, that's about how long people did, they would rotate in and out every few days. And I'm like, if that's all they have to give, that's great. I'm thankful for they're doing that. But I didn't come here to sit in a tree for 3 days, 5 days at a time, and then come down and maybe talk to the local radio station. Like, we got to do more here. These trees need more than this. Mm-hmm. But when the 3 weeks had come and gone, the area where Luna sits, the logging plant, the loggers had moved up into that part of the zone and had scared the activist who was up there down, and the tree was basically under attack. And for some miracle, they didn't cut the tree down that day. They just cut the rope that we used to get up and down with. So I went up the very next morning and I said, okay, I'm going to commit to staying for 3 weeks to a month, which at that time was very, very long. People didn't do that.
How'd you get up without a rope?
At the beginning, there were two baby trees growing out of the trunk of Luna. And you could actually wedge your body in between the two trees and it's kind of the wedge where you put your back against one tree and your knees up against the other, and you kind of scoot yourself up until you could grab the branches, and then climbed on the branches until I got to the rope, and then hooked on to the rope the way rock climbers climb, with harness. And mm-hmm. We didn't have Jumars at the time. We had what's called prussic ropes, where you tie little knots around the rope and it basically turns into a fist that holds you on. But it's a very kind of the most basic way to climb. And that's how I got up. And the very next morning, they actually cut those baby trees off the trunk of Luna, trying to scare me down. They said, "We're going through the trunk. You better come down." And I'm editing all the expletives that they said in there as well. And it was interesting because when they did that, they were trying to scare me down. The grace of that sacrifice of those trees is that when they did that, they actually cut their most easy way to have gotten me down. Because after that, the tree is 15 feet in diameter at the base. That's about 10 to 12 of us with our arms outstretched to go around the base of this one tree. So they can't climb the way they usually climb, which is they lash a chain around the tree and they wear spikes in their shoes and they flip the chain up the trunk and then use the spikes to hold themselves on. And that's how they got up and got other activists out of other trees. But they couldn't do that with a tree this big. And so then when they cut those baby trees down, they cut off their most effective way to get me down. And that was actually a big part of how I was able to end up spending 738 days without them being able to get me down, although they tried everything else imaginable. They cut trees at the tree that I was in, hitting the tree I was in with other trees, trying to knock me down. They hovered a twin-propeller Chinook helicopter above my head with 300-mile-an-hour updrafts trying to rip me out. They placed me under security blockade for 10 days with ropes and floodlights and security guards to cut off my food and try and starve me down. When that didn't work, they started blowing air horns all night and all day for 8 days so I couldn't sleep, trying to sleep deprive me down. So the list goes on. They tried a lot of things to get me down, but when they cut those trees off, that was actually the most effective way they could have gotten me. That one would have been a much harder thing for me to defend against than the other things I had to defend more against myself, my own mind, the breaking down of my mind, thinking I can't take one more day of this. I more had to deal with my own self than them.
I can't just, I guess most people cannot imagine living in the conditions you lived under. I mean, just living in a tree.
On a 4x6 platform?
On a 4x6 platform. Sometimes because the activists couldn't get through, not getting food and stuff to you, or water, I guess.
Well, actually, I devised a system when I was up there for just a little bit where I turned my roof into a funnel in my wall and one of my walls into a bowl with the tarps because the redwoods are temperate rainforest. A lot of people think rainforests are outside of this country, but we actually have rainforests here.
Right.
So even in the spring all the way into the parts of summer, there's even if it's just fog, there's quite a bit of fog coming through. So on a foggy day, I could gather up to a liter of water. On a heavy raining day, I could gather up to 10 gallons of water. So I actually, there was usually about a month to two tops out of the year that I would run out of water. As it got hotter, I would start conserving more water. I would, you know, wash my hair less, wash my clothes less, things like that to conserve the water. So the water was not so much of the issue as it was food and also battery supply for my phone. I had solar panels that were eventually donated to power the phone. But at that time, in the beginning, there was not a good solar setup. And so I was running out of an ability to communicate with anyone. And I'm 2.5 miles up a mountain. It's if you follow the road, it's you know, about 45 minutes, maybe half hour to get to the top. So that was a big concern about having people trying to kill me and not being able to tell anyone that they were doing
that. I mean, that people realize here what you were doing for those days, almost a year, more than a year, excuse me.
2 years.
Almost 2 years.
2 years, 8 days.
People did literally try to kill you.
Yes.
I mean, you told me the story when we met about the helicopter that's used to go in to pull trees out. Tell that story about what that helicopter does and what happens to the trees and what happened to you in that.
It was so interesting because this one day all these people showed up at the base of the tree and I thought, oh boy, here it goes. They're going to try and get me down again. And they took all this bright pink tape and they put this big circle around where I was sitting. And they use this tape also. They attach it to trees once they've felled them. And they use these huge twin-propeller helicopters. These are the kind of helicopters that carry military vehicles. They're very, very large. And they put pink tape on the trees that they've fallen so that the pilots in the helicopter can see where the logs are that need to be pulled out. And they have this huge chain that lowers down with a big claw at the end, and it grabs the logs and pulls them up. So when they came with that pink tape around me, I thought in my naivete that they were putting a place so that the helicopter pilots would not come too close. Well, little did I know that they actually are putting a bullseye, so the helicopters were, the pilots would know exactly where to come. And the day of this day where they came to try and get me out with the helicopter, these logging crew who are part of the helicopter crew came up, and I actually caught them on videotape saying, "Are you coming down today or not?" And I said, "Let me think about it." No. And one guy yells out, "Well, get ready for a bad hair day." And I hear the helicopter coming from around the mountain where it was on its landing pad. And it gets closer and closer and closer. And then it's like really right there. And I'm thinking it's going to move any second. It knows where I am. And no, it came directly to the tree. It was its first stop directly to the tree. And it was about 75 feet above my head. And that's so close that I could see the pilots in the helicopter. And the interesting thing is that they say that logging with helicopters is more gentle because it doesn't destroy the forest floor. But having seen it from my perspective, what it does do is destroy the canopy. The winds are so strong that it twists trees up like a rubber band. And then when it moves and that wind force lets go, the trees unspin and branches go flying everywhere. And what was once a tree is now a toothpick. And they, one of the things I noticed as well is when the helicopters came, all the animals left. The squirrels that were living in the tree before I even moved into their habitat, they left when the helicopters came. The deer left. All the migratory birds left. Like, the forest got silent when the helicopters came for about the week and a half or so that they were there logging. All the animals left because they destroy everything. So that was a very intense experience, both to see what it did to the forest, but also to feel that closeness of people who saw me so much as a label and a stereotype that they didn't care if they killed me, and they were right there looking at me as they did it. And as intense and difficult as it was also one of the profound ahas for me to realize that that's what we do when we stereotype or label, that we can actually annihilate people and not even think about it.
That is true. I mean, that's how people behave in many wars or any kind of hatred you have for another group of people. But why do you think that there was such a visceral and maybe deeper than visceral, even almost conscious hatred of not just you, but of this whole world of environmentalism? It's a very tough one, because if you think about the loggers for a second, the loggers are mostly men.
That's right.
But are family men.
That's right.
This is how they feed their children, and they love their woods as well. Mm-hmm. They hunt in them, they fish in them, they live in those woods or near them, and they have for generations.
That's right.
And they're not evil people. Mm-hmm. They're loggers.
Yes.
And then you have environmentalists come along, and many of the environmentalists come from urban areas, don't live in the forest as the men do who are cutting down the trees.
That's right.
And say, you cannot cut these trees down. These trees have been here for 1,000 years. They have to stay. You can't cut them down. So in some levels, I mean, there's a different set of righteousness on both sides, whether it's caring for what happens to the planet and the earth and the trees that have been here for 1,000 years that shouldn't be cut, or the men who are making a living with their hands and are hardworking guys trying to take care of their families.
Yes.
In a world where jobs are being destroyed and working families are falling through the cracks of the society.
Yes.
There's two worlds pitted against each other, against here, neither of whom in many ways are evil worlds. The evil worlds may be the ones who cut the paychecks for these men, but they're certainly not the men on the ground.
One of the things that I was able to use to build a bond with the loggers was because I come from a very poor background.
Yeah, because you came, we should say this to people because we'll talk about this in a minute. You're the daughter of an itinerant
preacher.
A poor itinerant preacher.
That's right.
Which is a really interesting story on its own.
Because I come from a poor background, I know what it is to work hard. My first job was when I was 5 to help contribute to my family's well-being. I've been working since I was 5 years old.
What did you do when you were 5?
Doing lawns. Yeah, mm-hmm. In the wintertime out here on the East Coast, shoveling snow. In the time when grass is growing, I wasn't, you know, quite big enough then to run a mower, but I was doing things like pulling weeds and all those kind of things. And as soon as I was old enough to start babysitting for money, I did that. You know, I've done a lot of jobs, but at my beginning when I was 5. And so I know what it is to work hard and still just barely get by. I also had to check myself because I realized when they were screaming obscenities at me and trying to kill me and doing really intense things, I had to realize that even though on the outside I was trying to look like I was all peace and love and everything, because on the inside I'm a human being, I realized that on the inside I too had a stereotype when I thought of Lager. And it was funny because in the beginning, I was trying to yell down from the tree to them, you know, do you know what you're doing? These are old growth, blah, blah, blah. I was up on my pedestal, you know? Oh, my goodness.
A very high pedestal.
A very high pedestal. And I, you know, I ask their forgiveness now. I'm so sorry. Some of the things I said, I'm just like, it's what happens when altruism speaks and there's not necessarily the wisdom with it yet. And I was that person, you know, I cared deeply. I meant well, but I had a little bit of a learning curve. And it was funny, whenever I'd start preaching at them in my own way, they would always manage to either say F you or start their chainsaw, which was another way of saying the exact same thing. And I realized, wow, this isn't being very effective, is it? So then I realized I needed to just get to know them. Who was I to tell them what I knew? I mean, I was new to the area. And as I began having conversations with them and they started opening up to me, because they realized I wasn't just asking them questions to try and set them up. I was asking them questions because I actually cared. I wanted to know. I wanted to understand. And I began to learn. These are third and fourth generation loggers. And their stories. And that's when I had this realization that there's not two worlds. It's not environmentalists and workers. It's the same system that is clear-cutting jobs and clear-cutting forests. They're both disappearing at the same rate. It's not two worlds. It's the system that's destroying the world we live in. And that system has to be addressed from all of us coming together. And that was the conversation I started having with them. And this one day I told these guys, I said, you know, one day we're all going to be standing in the middle of a clear cut and we're both going to be crying. And you're going to be crying because you have no more jobs left. And I'm going to be crying because we're not going to have any more ancient forest for your kids and their kids to experience. We're not going to have the lungs of the planet here breathing and taking care of our climate. But we're both going to be standing in the same clear cut crying. It was very profound to see that shift when that conversation started to happen. And part of the reason there is that visceral response from environmentalists to the environment is because we feel deeply this connection to the planet. From a worker's perspective, that visceral response comes from they feel deeply what it is to work hard, feel proud of their job, do an honest day's labor, go home and provide for their family. Both of them tap into something very deep within mm-hmm. us. Mm-hmm. And our challenge is how can we do the work necessary to get through that immediate visceral pushing a button response. And the way that I did it with them was just keep coming back with humor. That's a big one. Like I would laugh and they would make fun of me. And I'm like, that's the best you can do. And after a while, I was like, I've lived in a tree for a year. I'm better at making fun of myself than you will ever be. You know, and then after 2 years, I'm an expert at making fun of myself. And so it was humor. It was asking questions and actually caring what they had to say.
Did you actually get to know them?
Oh, yes. I ended up getting resupplied by loggers. I mean, it was incredible. I befriended some. Some of them actually ended up quitting the company because they couldn't work for them anymore. And it was really amazing.
So let me ask you this question before we... I'm going to move on to a wholly different area here. But I'm curious what you think the answer is then. I mean, I experienced many years ago, living in Oregon, in a place called Deadwood, where people who were radical environmentalists on a commune that I shared with were working with logging communities trying to come up with a way that to save the forest, but save people's lives. Mm-hmm. So I've always been very curious, but this is a very interesting idea to me about how we do what we have to do without destroying the lives of people who live in those woods. So what is the solution as you found it, or as you prescribe it?
My experience has taught me that the first step is to backtrack. And what that means is the first step is to take the time to sit down and get to know one another as people. The challenge is our issues are so pressing. Environmental issues are pressing. Job issues are pressing. They're so pressing that we're always in the emergency room and we're never thinking about holistic care. So we're constantly doing triage. And yet, if we're talking about long-term sustainability, we've got to get out of triage. We have to figure out how to create healthy communities. And that my experience has taught me that it has to begin with taking the time to get to know one another as people, not as issues. And that has made the best difference I've seen. And we don't always come up with a perfect solution that makes everyone happy. But for me, I find it to be the difference between what I call compromise or common ground. And compromise happens when we're in the emergency room, we're in triage, and we end up giving up things that are really, really vital to us only because we want to stop this bleeding that's happening right now. Common ground happens when you really get to know one another and you figure out, where can we create a world where one of our feet is in the world that we is really, really important and dear to us, and the other foot is sharing ground together? Because in that way, we create a solution that can most hold as many of us as possible. We're very diverse people. We are products of a system that has destroyed so much that it's hard to figure out holistic care when you're in the middle of devastation and destruction. But I feel we have to, and my feeling comes from very real experiences, is that's the way to move forward, is actually to step backwards first. Take that time, make that investment. And then once you have that solid investment, then the solutions to start presenting themselves. Whereas when we're dealing with issues, there's always an us and then them. And how can you find a solution that works for us when it has to be us and them? It can only really work when we find the space for all of us to step into a common space together and figure out how to move forward from there.
Maybe one of the reasons that it works in your case and that you were able to do some of the things you did was because of who you are and where you came from. I mean, I'm talking about the fact that maybe it takes a kind of a woman from poor working class roots to understand how to make that bridge to make this work.
I think that was part of it. Also, though, it's pretty base. My life depended on it.
That you helps, know,
my life depended on me figuring out how to work this out.
So when you decided, let's switch gears here, man. When you decided that you were going to allow for the first time some of your work to be shown at the American Visual Arts Museum in this new exhibit put together by Rebecca Hofberger and company at the museum, I want you to talk about some of the pieces you put in there and why you decided to let it happen now and let it happen at the Visionary Arts Museum here in Baltimore.
The artwork and writing that I did in the tree, I actually took food boxes from like couscous and soup packets and things like that that they would send up to me in the tree. And when I was done with it, I would turn it inside out because the inside is usable paper. And I would draw and write on it and then hand sew the edges. And the hand sewing part was actually meditative. I would usually do it when I was afraid or stressed out or overwhelmed. It was a really good way to, as I was stitching, unwind the tightness in my mind or in my body or in my heart. And it was a very powerful thing to have this completed body of work when I came down and to witness my own arc, my own growth emotionally, spiritually, mentally, and also to have these kind of captures of moments that were very intense along the way. And of course, even while I was still in the tree, people were asking for this to be shown in galleries. And ever since I came down, there's been many, many requests for it. But it never felt right to me for numerous reasons. But one of the reasons was I felt like it needed to have a larger container to hold it. I didn't want it to just be what feels to me almost like a freak show on display. Mm-hmm. Even with very well-meaning people, I understand I'm a little bit of a freak. I got that. I lived in a tree for 2 years. I know I'm a little out there. But how do you, like, how do you hold that within a larger context? And it felt to me that a lot of the requests that were coming in, it would have been like the display of, ooh, look, here's this thing, this woman who lived in the tree, almost like, you know, all the insects stuck on pins in a glass case.
Right.
Like, it felt like that
right.
to me. And when the request came in from Rebecca and the American Visionary Art Museum, and actually two other people called me that had come through and said, Julia, we really think this is the one for you to show, and like, we really want to encourage you to do it. And as I read about the theme, All Faiths Beautiful, and really realized that there would be that larger context, that this my experience is not an isolated experience. It's my experience in a global human experience. It's part of a tapestry. And to me, that's actually where its power lies. It's not just about one woman in one tree. It's about how does the thread of this story weave into the fabric of our lives. And I felt that the American Visionary Art Museum and this show in particular, it would allow it to be a part of that tapestry. And then the other thing is, as wild as it sounds, is this my work said, yes, this is where we want to go. All the other times, it's not so much that it's like it's a voice talking in my head, but so much as it is this energy around it. And the art had never before said, oh, yes, this is where we really want to be. And it was such a clear yes coming from the work. And then the work that I chose was trying to represent the themes of All Faiths Beautiful, including the not so beautiful. Because I think that there is something very profound in the profane. There's something very profound in the muck, in the mire, in the struggle, in the, you know, we're trying so hard to myself. I'm trying so hard to be transformed and enlightened to make a difference in the world, and I'm just falling on my face, you know? So trying to pick pieces that would show that arc, because it's really important to me that people don't see me as a celebrity, that they don't see me as a superhero. All those things completely disempower people. And I am not about the Julia Butterfly show. That's not who I am. I'm about, this has been my life. If my sharing it with you can somehow have you live a life that's more powerful than you can imagine, that can help you and support you in living your life in service to this world, then I'm so grateful. But please don't look at me as something other. And so part of the reason I picked some of the pieces I did, too, was to show my own humanity so that people don't fall into that stereotype or that myth of the celebrity superhero.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can just imagine, which we'll get to in a minute, that the fear that must have existed in you sometimes inside that, on living in that tree. I mean, the idea of living there for 2 years and 8 days.
Yes.
Having to do all the things human beings have to do.
Yes.
Or your bodily functions as well.
Absolutely. Everything.
Everything in that tree. The change in weather. People trying to kill you in a little teeny platform. How many feet high was it now?
180 feet.
180 feet.
18 stories up. For those who live in urban areas, think about a building 18 stories up.
I mean, it's just, there must have been many moments when you just said, I don't know if I can do this. I just don't know if I can do this.
Many, many times. People oftentimes come to me and say, I can't believe you did that. You're so courageous. Weren't you ever afraid? And I'm like, all the time.
All the time, terrified.
But right. The neat thing is that the only time courage comes into play is in that moment. You're not courageous if you're not afraid. There's no courage necessary.
Right. And you're a fool otherwise. Right.
And I remind people that the root word for courage is cœur, which comes from the French, which means heart. The only time courage is actually present is when we face fear, face overwhelm, face cynicism, and choose to act out of love anyway. That's the actual, by its literal translation, that's the only time that courage actually shows up. And so, yes, I was afraid a lot. And the great thing was it made me exercise my heart muscle and made it grow really strong.
Let me ask you to read a couple of pieces that are in the exhibit, and you can explain them to us. What they mean. Let's start with the crazy butterfly, because I think that has a lot to do with also the emergence of Julia Butterfly.
Yes, the crazy butterfly was I wrote it during the midst of the storms. I actually climbed up in the tree in what became the worst winter in recorded history of California. I always learn lessons the hard way, so I picked the worst winter on top of everything else. And this particular storm, it was just going on and on for days, and there'd be a little break and more storms would come. And the storms were crazy, and then I also felt like I was going crazy. And part of my journey was to embrace crazy, to stop having it mean something that made me pretend as if I wasn't going there, as if the world isn't there. We have so much meaning attached to things that it oftentimes keeps us from just embracing what's true, what's real. And what was real was I felt like I was going crazy. And to fight it was to break. But to embrace it was to find my way through. So that's kind of behind this poem. Crazy Butterfly. The wind rages, parading its might in a dazzling display of strength and passion. I feel the creaks and groans all around me. My thoughts get lost in the swirling madness. Dawn breaks, and with the morning wind abates, occasionally whispering wistful tunes to my wandering mind. Each day flows like the river here, gently meandering some, then rushing headfirst the next. Time is lost, a day, a week, and now a month is turning two. Immense and soaring highs, and painfully aching lows. I have crested snow-capped mountains and wept upon the fallen valley. Everything in between carries me, pushes me, onward, upward, outward, towards the sun, the moon, the stars, infinity. I am the same, yet different. Something integral, important, intense has changed. Metamorphosized into this being, I find myself enthralled. I have held hands with a goddess, purest passion for a love undefined, sacred, blessed, my spirit soars.
When did you decide to put a butterfly in your name?
Butterfly has actually been a part of my name since I was little. I was about 7 and a half or so. I was hiking in the Blue Mountains out here on the East Coast, and a butterfly landed on me and stayed on me for hours all the way until I got home. And it would fly from my head to my shoulder to my hand and back, but it stayed with me for a very long time.
What kind of butterfly do you remember?
I don't remember. My father even took a picture of it, but because it was so long ago, the picture's faded. So I don't remember what kind of butterfly. I just remembered that I actually had a pretty challenging childhood, and that day was very, very difficult. I was actually crying while I was hiking because I was very despondent. And that's a whole other story in itself. But this, even though I didn't understand the kind of philosophical nature of butterflies, and I didn't even understand the power of what they go through, becoming caterpillar to butterfly, it brought a sense of hope into my life that day, and it's been a part of my name ever since. And what was wild, I had no clue, but on day 100 of the tree sit, there was a rally, and a bunch of people hiked up the mountain to celebrate that marker that broke the world record at that point. And someone sent up a picture of a butterfly, and the actual name of the butterfly is a Julia butterfly. And I didn't know it, that there's an actual butterfly.
That's great. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So let's look at this one.
Sacrificial consumption. There's a lot of, I think now that, you know, people will hear the story, the deeper part of the story, they'll realize it's not true. But there's a little bit of a myth that people have this image of me sitting in the fairy tale forest in the lotus position, oming all birds, chirp, 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 chirping all around. And that's where I came to all this great enlightenment, you know. And people come up to me and say, oh, I'm so jealous of you. And I'm like, no, you're not.
No. Think again.
You're one of those people who want to take a diet pill in order to lose weight, not go to the gym and exercise, you know. You want the result without the work. And so there's this myth that was like this perfect experience, but I was living in an active logging plan. And by far, beyond the company trying to take my life beyond the storms, the hardest part for me was to bear witness. And it's hard for me to even talk about it without the tears coming, and here they come, because it's just so present for me. We live in a society that when you're upset or hurt, you go numb yourself. You go shopping, you go out to eat, you go watch movies, you do drugs, you do whatever you need to do to not deal with what's hurting you. But I couldn't leave. So for years, and the worst time was a few months, I had to sit there and listen as trees were cut down. I had to listen as these huge ancient trees make this loud scream as they go falling over, and then this thunderous crash, and then everything gets quiet for just a second. And it's almost like nature saying goodbye. It's so profound. Everything just gets silent. And then the noise comes back. And I was so grieving and so angry because I was hurt, like knowing that these trees aren't coming back, and watching what was once a forest in front of me being turned into a clear cut. I could see for miles, and I saw forest disappearing every day as more and more clear cuts were coming. And that was a reality of what I had to deal with. And it was a big part of my growing, was how to be present to that pain and not be consumed by it. This particular poem, Sacrificial Consumption, the tagline is Understanding Chainsaws. And it actually speaks about the irony that earth is used to make a chainsaw that then is made to destroy the earth. And that's what it's about. Isn't it ironic that these machines of destruction are made from the very blood and muscle of that which they destroy? Their greed, fueled by the blood of oil and gas and housed in the metal casing of muscle ripped from the body, feeds on the sacred, a sacrifice to the altar of humans' disrespect. And it's interesting, too, because part of the irony is the challenge we're dealing with around technology. They now have 7-foot chainsaws. You know, when they first started cutting these trees, they had men holding these blades, one on either side, and it would take them weeks to get through one tree, and now they can get through it in a couple of hours. And that disconnect, that when something that powerful can be destroyed so quickly, it's much easier to glaze over and miss what it is we're actually destroying.
I wonder, let's see if we have time for one more piece here, I think. And I think that, where should we go here? There's so many interesting things you've done. So many things I really liked. Let's go to Moments of Hope.
This one's fun. It's short, and it's fun because it speaks to when you get rid of all of the distractions, you become very aware of how much there is to be grateful for. It's so funny. When I went into the tree, when the media started, everybody was asking me, what do you miss about being on the ground? And then the minute I touched ground, everybody started asking me what I missed about being in the tree. And what it shows us is that we live in a society that has us miss our lives. We actually miss our lives because our life is happening right now. And all the time we spend missing the miracles of this breath, missing the miracle of this life, because we're so busy chasing what we don't have. When you have everything stripped away, it gets you really present to what you do have. And the breath becomes a joy-filled miracle. This particular poem, Moments of Hope, is about rainbows. And these rainbows were literally my anchor miracle. This one day, hail, it was a constant barrage of hailstorms. My roofs were made of tarps. They only hold up so long under hail. Mm-hmm. And it would be one hailstorm would blow through, and then there'd be a little break, and a rainbow would come through. The next hailstorm would blow through, and the break in the rainbow. And after my tarps were shredded, and I'm literally getting hit with hail, those rainbows were my anchor that kept me focused on there's something to be grateful for. I can make it through another storm. So that's what this is about. Moments of hope. Patches of sun break through the clouds, transforming mist and rain into prismic wonderlands. Dancing rainbows, colors scattered to the wind. But that iridescent moment is caught, held sacred deep within.
This is gorgeous. Yes, so short and so profound. Let's talk about Luna. Just talk about Luna, and we'll do this one next.
Okay. Luna, the tree was named Luna because the activist who hiked up the mountain to start the tree sit couldn't hike up during the day, because when you do direct action, you risk arrest. So it's a little hard to start a tree sit if you can't get to it without getting arrested. So the activist actually used the light of the full moon to bring up the ropes and the platform and the supplies up into the tree. And so they named the tree Luna after the full moon, as honoring that guiding light that allowed them to start the tree sit. And for me, I recognized Luna, not only is the word connotate kind of a feminine energy, but for me, the experience I was going through was so harsh and so stark. I needed some kind of nurturing energy. So I really related to that tree as a nurturing kind of mother goddess energy. And I'm not trying to create human qualities for a tree, but rather it was just I needed something. And so that's energetically how I related to the tree to help meet some very real needs I had of being okay in the midst of not okay. And so this is actually just a little note that I wrote on the next to this drawing. A lot of my drawings have women energy, tree energy. I'm not the greatest artist, but it's just a way of expressing what's going on inside of me. And this drawing is just Luna as a tree turning into a woman, and this kind of moon globe above the tree. And the little note just says, Luna, the tree goddess, may she stand forever as a symbol of what is right. In that moment, I wrote that because to me, Luna had become a symbol and now is, just as I had become a symbol. That to me, Luna was symbolizing what it is to be part of community. Like the tree's roots in a redwood are very, very shallow. They sometimes only go up to 3 feet deep.
Really?
Yes.
A huge tree.
Yes. And part of the reason they stand is because their roots go very, very far, and they intertwine with one another.
With other redwood roots.
With other redwoods, yeah. And also in the forest, they like their companion trees in that particular area are Douglas fir and tan oak as well. So all these roots are intertwining that create a web that help hold that hillside up, which is why when they log everything, it turns into mudslides, it destroys homes, it destroys watersheds, etc. So to me, the tree was a symbol of so much, of what it means to have healthy, beautiful nature, what it means to be a part of community, what it means to have a job that's a sacred job. These trees have a job, you know, and yet to me, it's a sacred job. It's about providing for others. And so that's really what that's really.
Let me ask you this. You use this word a number of times, spiritual and sacred, and you said that a lot of times in this conversation. And we talked last night about your growing up the daughter of an itinerant preacher, just having dinner. And you talked about your father, Dale Hill,
right,
who was this itinerant preacher. Great name for an itinerant preacher. Perfect name. And so you were rooted out of that as a child.
Right.
So talk a bit about that part of this for you. I mean, I'm very curious about how you intertwine what it is that you call your spiritual belief, and you're in this exhibition that honors all faiths.
Right.
And the root is a child, but what you've come to as a woman.
It's been a very intense journey, and growing up as a preacher's kid is not an easy thing to do, because you're supposed to be perfect so you can prove how your preacher father is really in alignment with God, because if the kid messes up, well, then something must be wrong at home, and if something's wrong at home, then something must be wrong with their message. And it's just really an inhumane way to grow up. It doesn't allow for the preacher's humanity, and it doesn't allow for the preacher's kid's humanity. So when I was 14, I actually went through a phase where I said, okay, I don't believe in God anymore. But then I, at one point, woke up and realized I was so angry at God that you can't be angry at something you don't believe in. So I was like, darn, now what? And it sent me on a journey that has gone everywhere, including into the pits of drug addiction and very self-destructive behavior. And I'm one of the lucky ones that made it out alive and didn't end up a statistic of that way of behaving. And I was just really searching for what is it that I believe in. And it's been an ongoing journey. What eventually happened in the tree for me was that I just awakened to that everything in life is sacred. And that I choose that not because it's an ultimate truth, but because it's a truth that serves me. If I see everyone is sacred, if I'm committed that life is sacred, it means I have to see somebody who's yelling at me in my face is sacred. It means I have to see that anything that's challenging me is sacred. I can't, it demands that I cannot create in us and in them. So my spiritual practice is actually a practice that commands and demands of me to be the highest me that I can be in the moment. And there are moments, as I mentioned, where I'm pretty pathetic. But in the moment, I'm doing the best that I can. But it's this constant command that says, how can I be better? How can I strive to honor all of life as one and not just have it as some spiritual new age conversation, but actually live it with every choice that I make, to the words that I speak, to the thoughts that I think. And that's really became crystallized in the tree again, because my life depended on it. It was about transform or die. So I chose to evolve and transform
and not to die. Let's read a few more of these, and then we'll start with a couple of drawings, and then we'll do a couple of poems, and then we'll just...
Right. Well, this one, that I don't know where the other part of the poem is, so I don't, okay. That's just a picture of Jay. It's a profound picture, but that's a picture that I drew after Gypsy was killed. He was a 24-year-old activist who a logger cut a tree down on top of him and killed him while I was in the tree.
While you were in a tree?
Yeah, it was very, very sad.
Did you see it happen?
No, but I was the first person. It actually happened in a grove away, miles away. But because it happened in a grove that was on top of a mountain, I was on top of a mountain, I actually had radio contact with the activist out there, and I was the first one to hear outside of the group that he'd been killed and had to call the news stations and the activist organizers and the medics and all that. And it was a devastating day. The man who killed him was caught on videotape saying, if I had a gun, I would kill you. Lots and lots of cuss words, very clearly out to get them. And when he cut the tree down, the result was a beautiful young man who was incredibly loving and creative and one of those people that everybody adored was gone. And I had to call his family. I'm still in touch with his mother. She's a profound woman. She took that deep loss and instead of turning it into rage, turned it into a commitment of healing. She's an extraordinary woman.
What about this?
This is a drawing that I did. It's actually a self-portrait without even looking in the mirror. It was just like I didn't even realize that that's what it was, but when it came through, it was very clearly this, like, the way I was beginning to experience myself. My mirror was literally 1 inch by 2 inches in the tree, so it wasn't like I was looking at a big picture of myself, but it was, I realized after I drew it that it was kind of this expression that came out of me of how I was beginning to experience myself. And it was this combining of oneness with nature, that we so live in this disconnected world that we've cut off the nature that's part of our human nature. And when we're doing that, we're destroying a vital part of ourselves. And this experience really reintegrated that connection with nature. So the lines are, I am hawk, I am eagle, I am all birds, strong, beautiful, and free. I am woman, I bleed, I am real. I am all things you want to ignore, but now I'm in your face. And I am loud, you can no longer ignore. Part of what that's about, too, was me embracing my own femininity as a fierce power. So oftentimes we think of words like goddess or femininity as a soft thing, as a passive thing. And especially growing up with a preacher for a father, you're taught that you're there to serve everyone else. You're not taught to really embrace your own power. And this experience and what was beginning to happen was me realizing that I could hold my femininity and still be very, very fierce, that they didn't have to be mutually exclusive.
I think people have to hear that line more.
You know, fierce femininity.
It is.
Yeah.
It was an Indian yogi that once said, and I always remember this line, because it cracks me up to talk about this story. He says, a couple things he stuck with me as I listened to him in this Indian accent. He said, if Jesus' disciples had been women, they would never have crucified him.
So, very good.
So let's just end with this one.
Okay. This one's called Grandmother Tree. This is one I wrote very early on. This was actually one of the first poems that came through me while I was in the tree. And it's called Grandmother Tree again, just tapping into that feminine energy that I felt was there. And it kind of speaks to this remembering what was and then seeing where we are now. And part of grandmother energy is the wisdom of our elders to remember. We live in a time of entire society of attention deficit disorder, and we live in a time of profound collective amnesia, and the results are we're not realizing the impact of what we're doing. And so elder energy is that representation of wisdom, of remembering where we've come from so that we don't perpetuate mistakes into the future. So that's a little bit behind this poem. I close my eyes and picture how things used to be, back when first I came to this majestic tree. And I think about what it must have been like before me, back when this grandmother tree used to have her family, gathered closely all around long before she saw them die, falling to the ground, shattering the air with their thunderous sound, chainsaws destroying their ties so tightly bound. Now I sit in her defense, looking at the beauty lost at whose expense, as I try to turn this horror into some kind of sense. Open my eyes and see once proud mountains sliding into shame. Who are we to decide that this wild we should tame? It's a desperate picture that these branches frame. I want to strike out at the ones to blame, but that won't heal this sadness too deep for name. So I sit in her defense. This tree is my grandmother too, looking at the beauty lost at whose expense. Well, I try so hard to turn this horror into some kind of sense.
It's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
You're listening to a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. To hear more and learn more, visit us on the web at www.centerforemergingmedia.com. And for the Center for Emerging Media, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.